Now, you might not automatically think that the head of the Catholic Church is an obvious topic for a Jewish podcast, but Pope Pius XII was in office during the Holocaust, and for three quarters of a century, many have been asking, should he and the Vatican have done more to stop it? This is the Jewish News Podcast. I'm Michael Daventry. Now, you might be thinking there are countless world leaders, countries, organisations who've been forced to confront their history, particularly how they behaved during the Second World War and what they did and didn't do as millions of Jews were being systematically rounded up and killed. What makes the Vatican any different? Well, the simple answer is that for a long time, the Vatican didn't confront its history, and it's important because the Holocaust wasn't just happening in Germany. Fascist Italy introduced its racial laws to restrict the rights of Jews and others in 1938, a year before the war. And by 1943, when Italy was being invaded by allies in the south and occupied by Germans in the north, Jews were being rounded up in Rome, in places that were a literal stone's throw away from the Vatican City. Pius XII did very little, although his advocates have always argued that he was held back by the circumstances of war, that there's only so much a pope can do in the face of genocide. The question of what little he did or didn't do was difficult to fully establish because his papers, his official documents, remained under lock and key and kept secret well after his death in 1958. In fact, things only changed under the current Pope, Pope Francis, who announced in March 2019 that in 12 months' time, he would finally allow scholars to look through all of that paperwork so that they could complete the picture of a papacy during the Holocaust. One scholar who was among the first to look through them was David Kurtzer, an American historian, professor of anthropology and of Italian studies, who has written extensively about Pius XII and his predecessors. He's written a new book called The Pope at War, The Secret History of Pius XII, Mussolini and Hitler. It was published last week in the United States and several other countries, although frustratingly not in Britain. We'll get to that bit later. When I spoke to Professor Kurtzer at the end of last week, I began by asking him about his feelings. On the one hand, it must have been a thrill to finally get his hands on these papers after so many decades of them being kept under lock and key. But on the other hand, the papers were finally opened up in the Vatican in March 2020, just as the coronavirus pandemic was taking hold in Europe, and Italy was on the front line.
There had been, as you know, many years of demands of the Vatican to open up the archives for World War II, given all the controversy over the silence of the Pope during the Holocaust in particular. And so certainly when the Pope Francis announced in March 2019, that he was authorizing the opening for a year hence, namely March 2020. Many researchers and others got excited that finally we'd have a much better understanding of what actually happened during World War II in the Vatican. Fortunately, I had kind of made a bet that Francis was going to finally open these archives. So I had been working for the previous years in the archives that were open, which are also very important, although they get less attention now, namely the Italian archives, the German archives, the British archives, the American archives, the French archives, because each of these countries had ambassadors to the Holy See, or envoys to the Holy See, who were sending almost daily reports throughout the war years of their conversations with the people around the Pope and with the Pope himself. So I had already digitized tens of thousands of pages of documents from those other archives when they opened the Vatican archives. So that was kind of, for me, the last piece of the puzzle. But as you mentioned, the COVID comes in too. So March 2nd, 2020 is the opening of the archive. I've moved into Rome, ready to spend the next months in those archives. And I'm there at 8:30 in the morning on March 2nd, 2020, when the archives were opened, and work there furiously the first week, when that Friday they announce while I'm there that they're about to close them until further notice due to COVID. Italy at the time was kind of the epicenter of the of COVID in Europe. And then there was a lockdown. Fortunately, they reopened those archives in June 2020, so they were only closed for 3 months. And fortunately, although I wasn't able to continue to stay there given the lockdown, I work with a collaborator, Roberto Benedetti, who's a historian himself and an expert in the Vatican archives, and he's Roman. So he was able to continue to work there essentially daily, and we were in daily contact, and the result is we've accumulated thousands of pages digitized from those newly opened Vatican archives, and that was the last piece of the puzzle for me in writing this book.
And a substantial part of the book actually is footnotes and endnotes and references. I mean, I think I'm not wrong in saying about 100 pages of, in addition to 400 pages of prose.
Yes, of small print. Yes, in fact, one of the sort of frustrations, I guess, although one should expect this, is that a lot of readers are never going to make their way through your endnotes. But there is a lot of juicy stuff there, aside from the fact that it shows where each of my statements are based, what they're based on in terms of their archival evidence. So from a scholarly point of view, they're very important. But of course, I tried to write the book for a much broader audience, not just for my scholarly peers, colleagues, but for a general audience interested in this history, so that I kind of, the way I wrote the book was to make it as kind of exciting and page-turning as possible, and leaving some of the more technical material, you might say, or scholarly material for those notes.
We then moved on to discuss the substance of his findings, and I put it to David Kurtzer that there was a school of thought that argued the Pope could only do so much as genocide was being waged across the continent of Europe. Did he agree with that?
Well, I wouldn't myself put it that way. I think the Pope could have done a lot that he didn't do, not least because in justifying the genocide and the persecution of the Jews, much reference was made to previous popes and church councils and warnings about the evil influence of Jews. And who was it who was carrying out the Holocaust? There were people who thought they were Christian. I mean, they didn't think they were pagans. And of those, about half, roughly, were Roman Catholics. And one can only imagine that in justifying how they were murdering little babies and so on, Jewish babies, they were thinking in part of what the parish priest had told them about the dangers of Jews seeking world domination and so on, that they had heard in their parish, in their parishes and from their parish priests. So, yeah, I think that the Pope bears a lot of responsibility in that sense. But that said, it is true that what you do have to understand the circumstances of the decisions he made. And from that, I think one important thing is to understand the time, that is when, the question when in the war. The first years of the war, the Pope had good reason to believe that that Hitler was going to win the war along with his ally, Mussolini. If you think of what happened in the spring of 1940 when the German army marched within a matter of weeks past the so-called impregnable Maginot Line and occupied not only the Netherlands and Belgium, but also all France, at the same time driving the British in ignominious retreat out of the continent. It looked like Hitler was going to dominate Europe. And in a Axis-dominated Europe, from the Pope's point of view, it was important to protect the interests of the church. So that's the first years of the war. Then later in the war, when it began to become more likely that the Allies were going to win, so now we're talking about 43, 44, into 45, the Pope had other considerations, namely, who were the Allies? Well, the Allies included the Soviet Union. And from the Pope's point of view, he was worried that the defeat of Nazi Germany would lead to the domination of Europe by the communists, by the Soviet Union. And there's another consideration that the Pope had at the time, namely, just because the Germans were, half of them were Catholic, more or less, or the members of Third Reich, they included Austria and the Sudetenland, he didn't want to be blamed for the defeat of Germany in the war. If he denounced Germany and denounced what they were doing, he thought that the German Catholics might turn against the Vatican, turn against him, and he was similarly worried about a potential schism in the church. So these were all factors in leading him to take the position he did and refuse to denounce the extermination of Europe's Jews while it was taking place.
And there was a point, as you've already said, in the war. I mean, let's talk specifically about 1943, when, you know, the Allied invasion of Italy had begun, when Mussolini fell, was reinstated in the north, and there was an effective German occupation in large parts of Italy, and there were Jews literally being rounded up on the Vatican's doorstep. You know, we're talking arrests, we're talking property being confiscated, and the Pope was weighing up, wasn't he? You talk about this in the book. It was weighing up the prospect of a diplomatic protest against Germany you tell us, what was it exactly that the Pope was thinking about doing, and how was he advised?
Well, I think there are two dates in particular that come to mind here. So the Germans occupied Italy beginning fairly early in September 1943. But already by October 16th, 1943, the SS attempt to round up all the Jews of Rome to deport them to their death in death camps, especially in Auschwitz. So October 16th, the SS, hundreds of them, go through door by door. They have lists of where Jews live. They arrest about 1,260 Jews, they send them to a military college just outside Vatican City. I mean, literally a stone's throw from where the Pope is. They keep them there for 2 days. And so the pressure on the Pope to do something is great for all sorts of reasons. And what the Pope did do is he had his Secretary of State call in the German ambassador to the Holy See the day the Jews were rounded up in Rome, and say, you know, this is terrible. Can't you do something? And the ambassador says, do you really want me to relay your concerns, your protest to Berlin? Because after all, this was ordered by the highest possible level, namely Hitler. And to this, the Cardinal Secretary of State says, well, no, I didn't say that. But I just said, you know, we're really quite upset about this, but I'm not telling you necessarily have to say anything to Berlin. And later the German ambassador would report to Hitler, essentially to Berlin, that although the Pope was under great pressure to speak out, he did not want to offend the Germans. So what he did do, interestingly, and this is part of what we discover in the newly opened archives of the Vatican, is the Vatican works relentlessly to try to determine who was baptized among the Jews who are being persecuted, and now the Jews who are being rounded up for extermination, and to be able to show the Germans their baptismal certificates, their baptismal records, to get them freed. And in fact, the Germans, despite the kind of common wisdom that the Nazis didn't care about whether, you know, religion, it was a racial matter, it was not true in Italy, because the Germans were eager to maintain good relations with the papacy, with the Vatican, with the Pope. And so, although 1,260 Jews were rounded up on October 16th, 2 days later, when they were sent off to their death at Auschwitz, there were only about 1,007 in the that were sent. 250 had been released, and they were those who were able to demonstrate baptismal certificates or demonstrate that they were Jewish men married to Catholic women who had pledged to raise their children Catholic. So then a few weeks later, kind of the next episode, major episode along these lines, the in occupying Italy, the Germans installed Mussolini in a puppet regime based in the north, the so-called Italian Social Republic. And so that government, technically, that is Mussolini's government, technically had authority over most of the peninsula. That is the peninsula that was occupied still by the Germans, which included almost all the Jews in Italy. And on November 30th, that new Italian government issued an order. The order was all Jews in Italy should be arrested and sent to concentration camps. All their property should be seized. So in light of this, 2 weeks later, the Pope, one of his advisors on Jews, suggested that perhaps he should not publicly issue a protest. That would be one step too far. But privately protest to the German ambassador. But the Pope had this recommendation sent to the man he regarded as his major expert on Jewish affairs, Monsignor Dell'Acqua, who later would become Cardinal Vicar of Rome. And we now have, as a result of the recent opening of these archives, the long document that the Monsignor Dell'Acqua sends analyzing whether the Pope should make a protest at all. And it's filled with the most anti-Semitic bile you can imagine. And it concludes that no, he shouldn't be protesting in this way. And in fact, the Pope does not.
So Angelo Dell'Acqua, Monsignor Angelo Dell'Acqua's briefing notes, his memo, whatever it is that you want to call it, that was influential over the Pope.
Yes. I mean, the one thing that's a bit of a mystery is why this man was regarded as by the Pope as his expert on Jewish questions, since he had no particular background that anyone's been able to find so far in dealing with Jews or knowing Jews. But he was, and he was viewed in this light. And so what would you see in the Vatican archives that have been opened is continuously referring Jewish matters to him for advice. And generally speaking, the Pope almost always following that advice.
Mm. So in the absence of any tangible reason why he had these views, can we just assume that he reflected a certain attitude of the time in Italy, which was, from a section of Italian society at least, that they were anti-Semitic?
Yes. I mean, of course, again, to be fair, anti-Semitism was much more widespread. It wasn't just in the Roman Catholic Church. But certainly the Catholic Church had been demonizing Jews for centuries and continued right up to World War II. So in that sense, these were views that were quite widespread in the church.
I'm just wondering about what you've just mentioned about the Catholic view of Jews and Judaism generally. I mean, it wasn't until the early 1960s, wasn't it, until the Second Vatican Council, when this whole idea that Jews collectively bear responsibility for the crucifixion of Jesus, that was only repudiated by a pope in the 1960s. So before then, it was official Vatican doctrine that Jews were collectively, even in the modern day, responsible for that. So I suppose my question is, should we really be surprised that there was so much of an anti-Semitic attitude while that Monsignor Angelo Dell'Acqua was writing these, was providing this advice, and why the Pope, when he intervened, was only intervening in the sense of trying to rescue anybody who had been baptized or who was married to a Catholic, rather than the wider number of Jews in the name of humanity? Should we be surprised by this?
Well, first of all, I think it is important to recognize that the Church did make a dramatic change in its attitude toward Jews with the Second Vatican Council, and then in 1965 with the statement Nostra Aetate. So we're talking about history here, not the current situation of the Church. But on the other hand, the Church has had great difficulty coming to terms with this history and being able to face it, despite various calls by recent popes to on the Church to confront history with open eyes and so on. The Church, because of all this controversy about the silence of the Pope during the war, during the Holocaust, charged its Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews, headed by a cardinal, with investigating, did the Church bear any responsibility for the kind of demonization of Jews that could have led to the Holocaust? And they released their report in the late 1990s called We Remember. And the Pope himself at the time, John Paul II, wrote a kind of introduction to the report. And it was a complete whitewashing of this history. It made a distinction between what they call anti-Judaism, referring to religious ideas about Jews being responsible for the death of Jesus and so on, but saying that this had nothing to do with modern anti-Semitism of the type that could have led to the Holocaust, which was based on social, political, economic, and racial matters. But it just isn't true historically, that if you look at church publications, what churchmen were saying, what was published, for example, in the pages of Civiltà Cattolica, the Jesuit journal that's overseen by the Vatican. It was filled with all these kinds of complaints about Jews seeking to dominate the world and enslave Christians and so on. So perhaps it's not surprising that anti-Semitism permeated the Vatican during World War II. What is perhaps disappointing is the failure of the Church to come to terms with this. I might add, though, that Some of the national churches, Catholic churches, such as in France and Germany and elsewhere, have begun to come to terms, admit this history, and begin to try to, in their terms, apologize for what they had done.
I'm struck by what the archivist of the Vatican's Secretary of State, a man you'll be familiar with, Johann Ix, said when he was looking at the same documents that you would have looked at and your colleagues would have looked at when they were first released. There's a quote here that was carried by the Associated Press. He says, "For the Jews, it was obvious and clear that Pius XII was on their side, and both he and his staff would have done everything in their possibility to save them." I mean, from everything that you've told me and everything that's in your book, it doesn't seem to me that they did do everything they could have done to save them.
Johann Ix, who's the director of one of the Vatican archives, the Secretary of State archive, actually wrote the first book to come out of these newly opened archives. Of course, he had the advantage of having access early, a book called something like Pius XII and the Jews, which has come out in France and in Italy. It's based entirely on his own archive, not even on other Vatican archives. But I think what it might have better been called is the Pope and Baptized Jews, because the great majority of the cases he refers to in that book are of Vatican help provided to baptized Jews. And this was a big distinction in the church. And I think the church, of course, for their own, from their own doctrinal perspective, regarded a Jew who was baptized as should be regarded as Catholic, not as a Jew. And this is where most of the efforts of the Vatican went. I mean, I think it's also important to make a distinction between, remember, before the Germans take over Italy in 1943, the racial laws had been in effect in Italy for 5 years, since 1938. Those were, you know, draconian anti-Semitic measures that the church never protested, except for insofar as they applied to baptized Jews who they thought shouldn't be treated by the state as Jews, but as Catholics and therefore exempt from the racial laws. So this, this is the reality of what was going on then.
The modern church, the Vatican today, it's the current Pope. It was Pope Francis who, as you said at the beginning, as when we first started speaking, he was the one who authorized the release of the papers after so many decades of them being kept under lock and key. Do you think that this, for the modern Vatican Church's point of view, is still representing a turning point in the sense that they're beginning to confront the history, even if they haven't digested it?
Well, I would hope so. I guess what makes me a little bit wary about being overly optimistic is when I published my first results from these newly opened archives in August of 2020 about a post-war case, the Finley brothers, the Holocaust orphans, who were being spirited from one monastery to another to be kept from their relatives who were trying to reclaim them after the children's small children's parents had been killed in the Holocaust in Auschwitz. And the French state had ordered the churchmen to return the children to the family. When I published my piece, because there's a lot of important material that are now available on that case in the newly opened archives, a week after this appeared in The Atlantic, this American magazine that gets a lot of distribution, the Vatican Daily newspaper, L'Osservatore Romano, published essentially a full-page denunciation of my article, and really of me, even though I don't think they could actually dispute the facts, which are based on their own archives, that I recounted in that article. So that for me was kind of a depressing sign, because I think there might have been reason to hope under the papacy of Francis that there would be finally a beginning to come to terms with this difficult history of the church and the Jews and the church and the Holocaust. But we'll see. My book came out not only in the U.S., but also in Italy. So we'll see what kind of reaction I get there, but I'm not terribly optimistic at the moment.
Well, that was the modern church. Let's end on history, the church of the 1940s. I'm going to ask you a very broad, generalist question, which is you're going to find immensely frustrating, I'm sure, but I think it's worth just asking as clearly as this. Was Pius XII a product of his time? Was he an anti-Semite?
Well, I think Pius XII was was part of an environment in which anti-Semitism was common, and he partook in that. He didn't have particularly great experience dealing with Jews. I mean, he had, of course, met some and so on. He was somewhat unusual as a pope, and he had never been a parish priest. He had never been a diocesan bishop. He had spent his entire life essentially in the diplomatic service. He had spent 12 years as papal nuncio in Germany, then 9 years or so as the Vatican Secretary of State under his predecessor as pope. So he had kind of limited experience with the Jewish world, you could say. So I don't believe that it was anti-Semitism per se that's the main explanation for his silence during the Holocaust. I think it was his priority for protecting the institutional church as he saw it. But certainly he was part of an environment in which there were, you know, many negative views about Jews.
David Kurtzer, whose book The Pope at War is available from Random House in the United States. It is due to be published in Britain by Oxford University Press, but I gather there's been a bit of transatlantic miscommunication going on, and it hasn't actually been printed yet. But no matter, the American edition is available here in the UK to buy from booksellers, including Amazon. And that's it from this week's edition of the Jewish News Podcast. My thanks go to David Kurtzer, to our audio producer Leo Mendel, and to you for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast in your podcast app if you haven't done it already. It helps us to know you're out there listening to us, and it also means you won't miss another episode. And if you'd like to get in touch, you can find Jewish News all over social media, but if you'd like to drop us an email, it's editorial@jewishnews.co.uk. Until next time then, from me, Michael Daventry, goodbye.